You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 12th of July 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London with me, Tom Edwards and Phil Hahn.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll be setting the day's news agenda with Oscar Guardiola Rivera from Birkbeck University. Oscar, what do you have for us today?
All the way from Chile, a story of crime unsolved. Scientists in the US are testing the poet Pablo Neruda's remains to establish whether he was poisoned.
Mysterious stuff indeed. Also coming up, the PKK announces the appointment of a new leader. But what effect will the hawkish Cemal Bayık have on the group's fragile peace with Turkey?
And we'll be heading to Copenhagen, where a new exhibition chronicling the country's Viking past has become one of the most talked about exhibits in recent Danish history.
The Viking Age was also a golden age, with lots of gold objects, provided you belonged to the right social group.
And in the second half of today's programme... we'll bring you part two of our special report from Brazil on the role art has played in forging the country's national identity.
People have no idea that European-style academic painting was being done by blacks in Brazil in the 19th century. We're living and teaching art in Paris.
All that plus we'll be checking in with our correspondent in Hungary and we'll likely play some music as well. That's all coming up in the next hour here on Midori House.
It's going to be a bumper show indeed here on Midori House today with Phil and myself. Before we get started on the show, however, let's catch up on the latest international news headlines with Paul Osborne.
The UN and the US are demanding Egypt's interim leaders halt the arrests of prominent supporters of the country's ousted president. Members of Mohamed Morsi's Muslim Brotherhood have been detained in the week since he was forced from office. His supporters and opponents both plan to stage rallies in Cairo later. Rachel Shabi, a journalist who writes on the Middle East, told us there's little sign the tension will ease.
Both sides are calling for demonstrations today. On the streets, the situation is entrenched as ever. Meanwhile, this transitional process by which Egypt is supposed to evolve and get out of this period of tension seems to be falling apart. It's becoming more and more obvious that the military is really pulling the strings.
The United States says China's failure to hand over the CIA analyst Edward Snowden has harmed trust between the two nations. The warning came at talks in Washington on cybersecurity. China insisted Hong Kong followed the law when it allowed Mr. Snowden to board a flight to Moscow, despite a US extradition request. Militants linked to Al-Qaeda are believed to have killed a senior figure in the rebel Free Syrian Army. Leaders in the group say they've been warned that others will also be targeted, in a sign of a growing rift between Islamists and more moderate members of Syria's opposition. Meanwhile, a division remains between the US and Russia over the best way to deal with the Syrian crisis. Russia has accused Western powers of delaying investigations into claims that chemical weapons have been used. Rosemary DiCarlo is the acting US permanent representative at the UN.
We have called for the investigation, as the Secretary General has, by the way, to include any and all credible allegations. The issue we're talking about now is to be united in calling for the Syrian government to allow the kind of impartial, thorough investigation that is needed to make a determination on this issue.
The Republic of Ireland has voted to legalize abortion under specific conditions for the first time. Ireland's Parliament, the Dáil, approved terminations where a doctor says a woman is at risk of taking her own life. But the bill does not allow for abortions in cases of rape or incest, or if the fetus is unable to survive outside the womb. A wave of gun and bomb attacks in Iraq have killed at least 44 people. In the latest sectarian violence, extremists targeted police checkpoints and mourners who'd gathered at a wake. At least 150 prisoners have escaped from a jail on the Indonesian island of Sumatra. They got away during a riot after a power cut knocked out water supplies. Some of the escaped prisoners were convicted of terrorist offences. Police and soldiers are searching the surrounding area. The body of a man's to be exhumed in the United States to allow for DNA tests to check if he is the serial killer known as the Boston Strangler. Albert DeSalvo once confessed to the 11 murders that took place 50 years ago. Now officials say DNA evidence links DeSalvo to Mary Sullivan, the Strangler's last victim. But local District Attorney Daniel Conley says the evidence only relates to the Sullivan case and not the 10 other murders.
Even among experts and law enforcement officials, there is disagreement to this day about whether they were in fact committed by the same person. At this point in time, 50 years removed from those deaths, and without the biological evidence that we have in the Sullivan case, that's a question that we cannot answer.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Really is amazing. After 50 years, they're still investigating that case. It's fascinating.
Grimly compelling. Yeah,
fascinating. Thanks very much, Paul. It is 6 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. And welcome back. You are indeed listening to Midori House, live from Studio One here in London with me, Phil Hahn, and Tom Edwards. Now it is time for us to set the day's news agenda with the three stories you'll need to know for the next 24 hours. Well, Oscar Guardiola Rivera from Birkbeck University joins us in the studio. Oscar, happy Friday. How are you?
Happy Friday indeed, although quite green stories.
You have some fascinating stories. A mysterious story, the mystery of Pablo Neruda, continues. Tell us about it.
Well, the deceased Nobel Prize winning poet Pablo Neruda is still in the news. A Chilean judge has ordered that bone samples from his corpse be sent to Spain and the US for fresh toxicology tests. Scientists in the US are testing whether Mr. Neruda's remains show traces of poison or whether he was, he died of natural causes, as maintained by the official story.
I guess it's interesting, isn't it, Oscar, to remember Neruda and look back at his work and the kind of man he was, and indeed what the sort of authorities in the country thought of him, you know, the sort of threat that he was perceived to be, and the reason, I guess, why these stories about a possible poisoning have so much traction. I mean, what do supporters of Neruda, there was, of course, his driver, wasn't it, who maintained he'd been poisoned for many years. Why are they so insistent? Why do they believe that it was definitely foul play?
Both the driver and his wife have been insisting for a very long time that he may have been killed. In fact, there is a precedent. There is a member of the opposition during the years of Pinochet's regime did die in hospital, and a judge confirmed that he had been poisoned. And apparently the same man who was responsible for the first crime may have been seen around Neruda by the time of his death. Neruda died on 22nd September, just a few days after the coup d'etat that took place in Chile on 11 September 1973. And although he was quite ill, every single one of his last visitors in hospital maintains that he was in good spirits. He was about to go into exile in Mexico, and he was about to denounce Pinochet's regime. And at the time, that would have been a blow to the regime, since Neruda was the most famous Chilean in the world.
Well, I was going to ask about that, because there was this feeling he was so sort of well regarded by, and it was by a huge cross-section of the population, wasn't it? That would have been incredibly damaging had he come out right at sort of the outset of that regime.
It would have been incredibly damaging. I mean, we must remember that these were kind of the origins of our times, in fact. You know, what we now call neoliberalism and so on and so forth did start in Chile at the time. And in 1973, Neruda, a well-known activist, was, as you said, well-regarded by peoples of all, ideological persuasions and so on. And a declaration of his at the time would have been really damaging. So hence the mystery.
Well, it would have been, of course, damaging 40 years ago, but 40 years later, if indeed it turns out that Neruda indeed was poisoned, what impact could that potentially have on Chile?
Interestingly, this year elections will take place in Chile once again. And although the current right-wing government seems to be behind in the polls, and everything indicates that Michelle Bachelet, the former president, will be elected once more, what has been happening in Chile, a bit as in Brazil and other countries in Latin America, is a sort of return of protest politics and radicalism. And if, you know, hence the importance of this story, the memory of Allende and Neruda, all those things seem to be actually setting the agenda of politics 40 years on.
And Oscar, it's interesting, isn't it? Obviously, Neruda's literary legacy endures without any question, and all around the world, indeed. But I wonder, do you think that his impact as a character, as a sort of a representative of that movement of dissent, is that the same today? Or does it necessarily lose some of its impact just with the passing of time? Do you think it can still galvanize people? What about the younger generation? Is he still a figurehead for them?
Well, in a sense, you know, some people have talked about the sadness of a time without masters, and that those are our times. And yet, the younger population, particularly in places like Latin America or North Africa, are looking at the past and finding that certain opportunities were lost, but maybe rescued. And for instance, in Chile, the newer generation, the former leaders of the student movement, Camila Vallejo, Giorgio Jackson, those guys were looking at people like Neruda and Allende and finding that what they were saying 40 years ago is still very relevant.
And Oscar, let's stay in Chile. Quite a horrific case, though, involving an 11-year-old rape victim.
And actually, this story does relate to the previous one. It shows how the past still weighs on the shoulders of people here in the present. Chilean President Sebastián Piñera caused controversy by praising as brave and mature, his words, a pregnant 11-year-old rape victim who said she was happy to have the child.
But she was she was raped for 2 years by her mother's boyfriend. Obviously, at that young age, you don't really have any concept of, you know, the difficulties of raising a child. But she came out of this interview saying, "I'm going to love the baby very much, even though it comes from that man who hurt me." It's just staggering, isn't it?
But that's the problem here is, again, it goes into politics. It's not just the and in a sense, that explains the psychology behind this. Part of the legacy of the Pinochet years is still very much alive in places like Chile. And it is demonstrated in cases like this, in which a certain brand of strong social, extreme social conservatism allied to, you know, Catholic beliefs and so on still sets the agenda. And in this case, you know, the 11-year-old girl came out on TV. She said that having the child would be like having a doll. And of course, after the president praises those words as brave and mature, you know, the experts come out and say he has no idea what he's talking about. In fact, forensic psychologist Giorgio Agostini put it thus: what the president is saying doesn't get close to the psychological truth of an 11-year-old girl.
Oscar, you mentioned there about the sort of twin influences of this. There's social conservatism, which is of course allied to Roman Catholic sort of views on this issue. How does the situation in Chile compare then? Because we're used to seeing, well, it's quite a divisive issue, to say the least, across the region about these kind of instances. Are the drivers for change in this area and people's attitude, are they going to be political or are they going to be religious? Because it's interesting, of course, the Pope is heading to Brazil very soon. His pronouncements on this, well, on this specific issue, we're not quite so sure. But again, he's kind of a generally fairly pragmatic figure politically. Do you think the drivers for change will be political or do they have to come from the church?
In fact, it is absolutely the case, as you suggested, that this story is going to drive the agenda of the Pope's visit in Latin America. Of course, everybody's waiting to hear what he says, particularly in Latin America, especially given the fact that the previous Pope, in a sense, the previous two popes, were widely seen in Latin America as being very conservative. This one is seen as, pragmatic little bit more progressive, perhaps, but it's going to be very important. Why? Because this is a political as much as a religious issue. And this is the trend of the times. Politics is becoming religion. Religion is becoming politics. Social conservative values are sort of the currency of centrist and center-right politicians. And but also it does matter as in cases like this when the health and life of millions is at stake.
Oscar, unfortunately, that is all the time we have for today. Thanks very much for setting the day's agenda. Oscar Guardiola-Rivera from Birkbeck University, many thanks for joining us here on Midori House.
Coming up, we'll have a profile of Kemal Bayık, the new political leader of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, the PKK, and ask how his appointment might impact the group's fragile peace with Turkey. That's coming up right after this.
Aspiring for greener cities and easier commutes, more and more people are switching to bikes. From Zurich to Toronto and on to Buenos Aires, we film pedal makers who've opened up artisanal bike shops to provide bespoke services for two-wheeled enthusiasts.
Frames are recycled and reworked, featuring Monochrome's minimalist design aesthetic. This bespoke upcycling has turned them into one of the Argentinian capital's greenest takes on transport.
Bike shops with a difference. In the film's menu on monocle.com.
And welcome back to Midori House, where the time here in London is 8:16. Now, the PKK, the Kurdistan Workers' Party, has reshuffled its top table, with both the group's military and political wings now boasting new figureheads.
The PKK and the Turkish government signed a peace agreement back in March, in which the PKK agreed to withdraw its 2,000 fighters from positions across Turkey, in return for greater self-determination for the Kurds and a more prominent role for the Kurdish language in the Turkish constitution.
Well, the fragile peace in this 30-year-old conflict seems to have held so far, but does the appointment of a new leadership at the PKK risk shifting the dynamic between the two sides in this apparently deadlocked peace process? Well, to answer that, we're joined now by Fawaz Jerjes from the London School of Economics and Political Science. Fawaz, many thanks for joining us here on the program. Give us a quick profile of this of the PKK's new leader, Kemal Bayık.
Well, Kemal Bayık is really represents continuity as opposed to change. He is known very much for his harsh rhetoric. He is portrayed as a hardliner. He is a founding member of the PKK. He is a very close ally of the imprisoned leader of the organization, Abdullah Öcalan. But the reality is, what we're talking about, this is a transitional period. All eyes on the fragile, as you said, peace process between the Turkish government and the PKK. Positively, the party declared its commitment after the announcement of the new appointment, is still committed to the peace process, even though it criticized the slow pace and the vague promises by the Turkish Prime Minister Erdogan. So I don't see any radical shift, but the reality is this reaffirms the position of the imprisoned leader, Abdullah Öcalan, and the party.
So, Fawaz, it's interesting, isn't it? They haven't really given any reason explicitly for this change in leadership. You mentioned there about continuity. I mean, is it wrong then, looking from outside, to try and find reasons behind this shake-up? Is it just to freshen up the personnel? If he is a believer in continuity, will this make any real difference? What do you think the motivation is within the PKK, particularly from the top brass, to make this kind of change? There must surely be some kind of justification for it.
Well, obviously, I mean, I think this tells you a great deal about the balance of power within the organization itself. And also it tells you about the fact that they're trying to bring fresh blood and dynamism and momentum to the party. Obviously, there is a struggle of power within the organization itself. But the reality is, from everything that we know, Abdullah Öcalan is still, in many ways, the really, real driver behind the PKK, both sides, the Turkish government and the PKK, are involved in a campaign to try to really maximize their bargaining power. And I think it seems to me the next few weeks are extremely critical. because even though the ceasefire has held, the Turkish government says only 20% of the 2,000 fighters have really pulled out from Turkey. And there have been some clashes in the last few weeks. And Prime Minister Erdogan is coming under tremendous pressure internally inside Turkey. So the reality is, I mean, I think there are alarming signs. The appointment of a hardliner, in particular his rhetoric, tells me also that the PKK is trying to position itself just in case that the peace process does not really take off to continue the fight against the Turkish government.
Because Fawaz, earlier this year, the peace process did look very promising. We had the reports of the PKK fighters disarming. Do you now think that with this appointment of Cemobayek that the peace process is perhaps finished?
No, the peace process is not finished. The peace process is very fragile. And I think both camps are trying to position themselves to really get the maximum out of this particular process. Remember, what the PKK wants, it wants constitutional rights for the Kurdish community inside Turkey, which represents about 20% of the 75 million people who live in Turkey. They live mainly in southeast Turkey. They would like autonomy. They would like their language to be recognized. And in their view, the Turkish government has been very slow. It has not carried out its promises. And I think this appointment could be seen, should be seen, as part of the message and the pressure that the PKK is trying to exert on the Turkish government in order to carry out its promises of more recognition, cultural recognition for the Kurdish community inside Turkey.
Fawaz, we're almost out of time, but I just wanted to ask you very briefly. We've seen obviously a lot of protest and dissent in Turkey recently. Do you think in some respects the PKK will have welcomed that disorder because it gave them a bit of a platform, a bit of breathing space to regroup, to refocus on their agenda? Do you think counterintuitively it's actually provided them with an opportunity?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, the irony, they celebrated the protests, yet the Prime Minister, the Turkish Prime Minister, accused the PKK and some terrorist elements of spearheading the protests against his rule. And this tells you that even the Turkish Prime Minister, falsely asserted that some terrorist elements of the PKK variety were involved in the protests against his rule. He was trying to appeal to the nationalist base of his supporters inside Turkey.
Fawaz, thanks very much. We're going to have to leave it there. Fawaz Jerzhes from the London School of Economics. Many thanks for joining us on the program.
Now on Midori House, we look to Copenhagen, where a new blockbuster Viking exhibition has just opened at the Danish National Museum, entitled simply Viking, and featuring pieces from the museum's collection as well as objects loaned from all around the world. It runs until November. In the spring of next year, it will open a new exhibition space at the British Museum right here in London.
Monocle's Copenhagen correspondent Michael Booth went along to the museum to meet the exhibition's curator, Anne Pedersen. He began by asking her what surprises might be in store for British visitors next year.
The extent of the Viking world, where they travelled, including the travels to present-day Russia and the Ukraine, could be interesting. There would also be some silver finds, where you can see that there are silver hoards, great silver hoards that have been recovered in Britain, but also silver hoards that are similar to the Danish ones. And then as a contrast to the silver, we have attempted also to show gold, that the Viking Age was also a golden age with lots of gold objects, provided you sort of belonged to the right social group, then you would also have gold.
From Anne Pedersen's office in the National Museum, we head to the exhibition itself, jumping the rather long queue and making straight for the gold.
So we're in the jewellery section here.
Power and glory.
Yeah.
How do you demonstrate who you are, what you are, and how much you can do?
There's a lot of bling here, right? There's a lot of gold.
Whole bling case, but in an attempt to really create a contrast to the silver, which is something that we know of, and we know it was used in trade, we have gathered gold to demonstrate that if you're really up in the upper levels of society,
the way you demonstrate your alliances or your friendships, and you also maintain them, is by having gold and giving gold.
Let's have a look at some of the amazing gold jewelry in here. There's a gigantic necklace woven from
gold
thick gold thread.
Yeah.
Tell me about
a little bit is missing, and that's a damage, presumably when a plow hit it. But
it must be almost 80 centimeters in diameter.
Yeah. If that missing section that has been cut off, if that had been there also, it would have weighed about 2 kilos.
Wow. And that was found quite close to Copenhagen, right?
It was found in Western Sjælland at the site of Tissø. Mm.
From the jewellery and weapons, we move into the main hall, where King Canute's pride and joy is on display. It's the largest ever Viking ship find, 37 metres long and capable of carrying up to 100 men. Ironically, given that King Canute conquered England 1,000 or so years ago, perhaps with a fleet featuring this actual ship. The ship will now be returning to London in the spring.
Here we are in front of the undisputed star of the show. Perhaps you can describe to me what we're seeing.
You are seeing at the moment a shipwreck. And as a shipwreck, you can imagine that it's only partly preserved. It's about 20% of the original ship is preserved and has been freeze-dried here at the museum, so it's been possible to reassemble the parts.
But it's not just any old ship, is it? This is the largest, is it right, the largest ever Viking ship find?
It's the largest that we know of, and the reason we know that it is the largest is that, fortunately, the keel of the ship was almost preserved intact in its full length, apart from a section where, as you can almost see here, the edging of the excavation cut through the ship, so you can see the piling there that cut off the keel.
Because it was found right next to the Roskilde, the existing Viking ship museum. That's the irony of it. They were extending the museum where they keep 5 or 6 ships that were found way out in the Roskilde Fjord, and they found this one next to the museum.
Yes, right down in the centre of Roskilde Harbour. It was still there. When you look at the ship, the original parts, you can see the wood, you get a lot of information from that. We can see that it was built of oak around 1025. The oak came from the Oslofjord area, so it presumably came from there.
So it was built in Oslo?
In that area. Can't say Oslo exact, but in that general region. And then there are signs of repair. So it was repaired in the Baltic around 1039. And then it ended up in Roskilde, possibly around the mid part of the century.
King Canute?
That is the time of King Canute. And the size of the ship and the nature of the ship, we could speculate whether it was actually his ship or at least a magnet ship of the time.
So it's quite possible this could have been to England and back a couple of times.
Possibly, but since it was repaired in the Baltic, we could say that, yes, perhaps it just, you know, cruised around the Baltic to expand there and maintain order in
the Baltic rape and pillage circuit.
Yeah.
And behind the ship you have a projected film, an animation, as if you were on the ship sailing to the UK or to England.
And that is because we have chosen here, rather than show only the original parts, since we have the information from the original parts of the ship, we have chosen to design a support for the ship, which at the same time demonstrates the lines and the size of the complete ship as we have reconstructed.
Yeah, so just to explain, the remnants of the boat, the wooden planks, are carried in a metal frame that recreates the exact size of the ship. And when you're standing down on the ground, we're standing up overlooking it. When you're standing down there, it's really quite an imposing sight.
Yeah.
And there may have been a fleet of 100 or 200 of these at some time.
There would have been a fleet of some size. If you were at the receiving end of an attack or a conquest, I mean, it's only human if you exaggerate the numbers of it. So we can't be sure if the numbers are completely exact.
It would have been a frightening sight, though.
It would have been a frightening sight.
Mostly because of the speed they would arrive at.
And also the speed and the number of men once they depart from the ship. And then to create an atmosphere around this large and in many ways static object, we have this projection behind it to create some life and to put this object in a setting, meaning that it belonged on the sea. It didn't really belong, as we see here, in
a darkened room.
Were there any traces of the men who sailed in this ship? Graffiti
there,
or carvings?
There is one object that was found in connection with the ship, below the ship. It is a wooden stick with a stylized bird's head at one end and then the other end pushed through a stone with a hole in it. Whether it was a tool or it was a plaything or whatever it was, we don't know. But on that it said that Saxe carved these runes. And that's about it. Whether Saxe was one of the men who actually sailed on the ship, we can never know, but it may have been.
The ship isn't just the star of the show. Curator Anne Peterson and her team have used it as the inspiration for the four main themes of the exhibition, as she explained.
What we've done is actually we have the ship as the centerpiece of the exhibition, and as a researcher, you look at the ship and you get ideas. And the four main ideas are what we have then folded out in the exhibition. So you have the first section, which concentrates on the aspect of the ship as a means of transport. Therefore, the first section is the Viking world. Where did they go? And what did they bring back? The next section focuses on the ship as a warship. Therefore, the weapons and the heroic side and perhaps also the mental side of being a warrior. A ship of this size is also a major investment and a statement of power. And you must imagine that you've got the ship, but you also have to pay for a mast and a sail. Therefore, our third section is sort of power and glory. How did people at this time show power, maintain power? And then the last section, the ship is a wreck. It's from the close of the Viking Age in Denmark. So it's obvious to look at another major change, that the Viking beliefs were gradually replaced by Christianity.
Monocle's Copenhagen correspondent Michael Booth there, reporting from the new Viking exhibition at Denmark's National Museum in Copenhagen. Just ticking towards 8:32 here in London, let's get the latest news headlines from all around the world with Paul Osborne.
The United Nations and the US have both demanded that Egypt's interim leaders halt the arrests of prominent supporters of the country's ousted president. Members of Mohamed Morsi's Muslim Brotherhood have been detained in the week since he was forced from office. His supporters and opponents are both planning to stage rallies later in Cairo. The US has said China's failure to hand over the CIA analyst Edward Snowden has harmed trust between the nations. That warning came at talks in Washington on cybersecurity. China insisted that Hong Kong had followed the law when it allowed Mr. Snowden to board a flight to Moscow, despite an extradition request from the US. Militants linked to Al-Qaeda are believed to have killed a senior figure in the rebel Free Syrian Army. Leaders of the group say they've been warned that others will also be targeted. It's a sign of a growing rift between Islamists and more moderate members of Syria's opposition. The Republic of Ireland's voted to legalise abortion under specific conditions for the first time. Ireland's parliament has approved terminations, but only when doctors say that a woman is at risk of taking her own life. And at least 100 prisoners are known to have escaped from a jail on the Indonesian island of Sumatra. They got away during a riot in which at least 5 people died. It was triggered by a power cut which knocked out water supplies. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Paul. Paul will be back at the top of the hour with another check of the world news. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Tom Edwards. The time is 16:33 in Seoul. It's 11:33 in Dubai and 8:33 here in London. Your name's not Time, it's Tom.
I don't mind that as a nickname.
Time Edwards.
I'm just like clockwork. Time Edwards. I'll take it. And it is indeed time now for the second and final part of our special report on the arts in Brazil. Yesterday, you'll remember, on Midori House, Jack Phillips spoke to some of the country's singers, painters and museum curators on how culture has helped to forge the nation's idea of itself.
Well, today, Jack heads to the Museu Afro-Brasil, which chronicles the history of the country's Afro-Brazilian population, and asks how, against the odds, this vibrant section of Brazil's diverse ethnic makeup has asserted itself within the national consciousness.
The Brazilian Afro Museum is housed in a large Oscar Niemeyer building on the edge of Ibirapuera Park in Sao Paulo. Founded in 2004 and funded in association with the Ministry of Culture and the social organisation of culture, this former mayoral office houses a vast archive of Afro-Brazilian artwork, literature and film. 70% of the collection is owned by founder Emmanuel Araújo, having spent decades building a collection. Renato Araújo, a researcher for the museum, believes the collection represents a forgotten and disregarded part of Brazilian history.
Our library is called Carolina Maria de Jesus. That was a writer, Brazilian writer, that in fact she was garbage collector in the streets. She lived in the slum, so she was very much had a lot of talent as a literature, but also have a lot of awareness of the whole situation of black people here in Brazil.
Brazil has the largest African community outside of Africa, making up around 50% of Brazil's population. Since the abolition of slavery in 1888, little has been done to highlight the Afro community's influences on Brazilian life. Dr. George Nelson Preston, Professor Emeritus at the City University of New York, is a scholar of African art, as well as a curator, poet, and Akan chief. He is one of the foremost art historians and collectors in the US. Preston believes that the Afro Museum goes a long way in generating a new understanding of Brazil's heritage.
Brazil, outside of Africa, is the largest Afro-descendant country in the world. And yet the cultural contribution of Afro-descendants is not clearly understood by most Brazilians, even Afro-descendants. The Museu Afro-Brasil is dedicated to the explanation and the understanding of that culture, but not only directed at Afro-descendants, but to all Brazilians, and to relate the interface of that culture to greater Brazil and to the world, to Europe, the Caribbean, Brazil, the United States, so that we understand this watery continent, the Atlantic Ocean, which is really the Afro-Atlantic continent or the Atlantic community.
The contributions made by the African community in informing the traditional ways of Brazilian life are vast, spanning everything from language to national dress, and are inspired through its rich history of celebration and through its work ethics. Nida de Almeida is the education coordinator for the museum, a role which oversees the creation of programs that aim to teach schoolchildren about their Afro heritage. Using music, dance, and specially adapted classes for the blind, the museum performs an important role in the education of the young in São Paulo.
Here at the Museum Afro Brazil, we have a large collection that displays a variety of themes and languages through artists and artworks. And it is all available to a public that are unfamiliar to this type of material and experience.
The collection at Museu Afro Brasil represents six great themes: Africa, work and slavery, sacred and profane, Afro-Brazilian religions, history and memory, and art. One of the most stunning permanent exhibitions is the Slave Ship Room, where the skeleton of a slave ship, coupled with installations, photos and objects, help honour the memory of the Africans brought to Brazil.
People have no idea that European-style academic painting was being done by blacks in Brazil in the 19th century. We're living and teaching art in Paris.
In addition to the exhibition spaces, performance areas and administrative offices, the museum also houses the library Carolina Maria de Jesus and Theatre Ruth de Souza, as well as artworks by two very influential twin brothers.
This exhibition we show two brothers, João and Arthur Timóteo da Costa. They were students in the Fine Arts School in Rio de Janeiro in the very beginning of the 20th century. Arturo went to France to learn the academic painting, and come back to Brazil and continue to do his works. Many scholars make some links with the beginning of the modernism in Brazil because, in fact, Arthur has died in 1922, the very year we point the beginning of modernism in Brazil, particularly in São Paulo. But he already had first signs of modernism in his art. The slavery here in Brazil ended 1888. They are very young at that time, and they began to learn. Unfortunately, they are not known too much, but we have in this, particularly in the universities, we had some different works showing that they were very important to Brazilian history of art.
What seems to be most important for the museum is not the preservation and display of African Brazilian art, or indeed the tourism it draws to the area, but the education programs it endorses to the children of the city. Racism has long been endemic in the Brazilian community, and although this is slowly changing, institutions such as the Museum Afro-Brazil help to muster a community togetherness in the youth that pay a visit.
This museum tried to show that our roots are very, very much closer to Africa, because since the very beginning of Brazil, in the beginning of the 16th century, when the Portuguese came here, they only was a man. So there is no white woman in many, many decades here in Brazil. Then the Portuguese came in the make a relationship with native Indians and with African women. And our roots are very much mixed, not only in culture, but also in DNA. So in the development of the colonialism of Portuguese here in Brazil.
You cannot forget the contributions that were made, not just in music and in cuisine and in the language, but very few people realize the great contributions that black painters, sculptors, musicians, and I mean classical musicians, and scientists made in the 19th century. They were not all slaves. What happened in Brazil at the turn of the century, after abolition, is the government wanted to Europeanize Brazil. They didn't want to have what would be seen as a black republic or a mulatto republic. And they brought in all of those Europeans with technical skills that actually many blacks had already developed in the 19th century.
Since the 1940s, Brazil has been called the country of the future. The tag has hung on for so long, it has generated another adage. Brazil is the country of the future, and always will be.
Sort of recovering the true history in a way, exposing the true history of what the complexity of Brazil is. We cannot disassociate that Brazilians are not either to the indigenous or Africans or Europeans. We are the Brazilian people that mix, that Hanting was saying. And denying that truth is denying who we are.
Experts say that Brazil has become a much more exciting place for young artists than the more experienced ones, and it's easy to see why. As a result of their vigorous youth, institutions and independent galleries are opening up experimental spaces in order to facilitate creativity. The Museum of Sculpture, the Museum of Image and Sound, and the Afro Museum are examples of the state taking a vested interest in Brazil's art while simultaneously instilling within its young the breadth of Brazil's diverse heritage. This nurturing will no doubt spur a future generation to investigate what it is to be Brazilian in the 21st century, perhaps capturing the soul of Brazil in the process, just one of the many elements that make the country so distinctive and so appealing to the rest of the world.
Brazil now is in the spotlight. The world is asking, what's happening in Brazil? Why you guys do this? Why you do that? What's your architecture? What's this? What's that? And it's very important that we talked about this. And that's the truth to any country. For me, any country to move on to the next level, they got to understand who they are. When you understand who you are, then you're a global citizen. Otherwise, you don't know who you are. You cannot be nothing. You're just up in the air.
That was Monocle's Jack Phillips reporting from the Museu Afro Brasil, concluding his special report on how Brazil sees itself through the eyes of its artists. And you can download Jack's report in full from the special report section at monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House. We'll be heading to Hungary next for a check-in with our correspondent there. That's right after this. And you are indeed listening to Midori House. We're going to leave the comfortable confines of Studio One here at Midori House and head over to Hungary. That's where our Monocle's Adam Labor is. He joins us on the line. Adam, welcome to the show. Let's begin with a story about 500,000 new Hungarians heading your way.
Yes, well, we're not sure if they're heading our way, but they're definitely 500,000 new Hungarian citizens. What's happened is that there's an awful lot of Hungarians, around 5 million Hungarians, they estimate, live in the countries around Hungary that border it, like Serbia, Romania, Slovakia, and Ukraine, because in 1920, Hungary lost two-thirds of its territory, thus stranding a lot of its citizens outside the borders. And the government here has really made it very easy indeed for them to get citizenship. But the controversial part of this is that not only do they have citizenship, they can vote in the next election. So you're going to have a lot of people being able to vote who don't pay taxes here and don't live here.
Adam, what's your sort of verdict on this? How's this playing domestically? Is there obviously quite a lot of controversy? What does sort of media make of it?
Well, this is a very polarised country. So half the country thinks it's great, the half that supports the government. You know, we have a conservative/right-wing government here, who they say they're just extending citizenship to, you know, their cousins and brothers, same as, for example, Romania has done in Moldova. Romanians issued perhaps 100,000 passports to Moldovans. So they, the people who support the government think it's great, and the people who don't support the government think that the government's engineered it to help themselves win the next election, because many of these people are likely to be government supporters, partly out of gratitude because the government's made them citizens. Now, if you're a citizen of a country like Slovakia, doesn't really matter if you've got a Hungarian passport. But if you're Romanian, it can be useful, because even though Romania's in the EU, it's not part of the Schengen zone, so you have to get visas to go everywhere. And if you're Ukrainian or Serbian, it's incredibly useful because you get an EU passport.
Adam, let's move on to another story which you've highlighted, and it's all about corruption.
Yes, Transparency International has just published its Global Corruption Barometer for 2013, and the results are pretty grim for Hungary. Almost two-thirds of Hungarians think that corruption's increased in the past 2 years. 80% of Hungarians think that the government's decisions and and its actions are influenced by its close connections to certain business circles. And perhaps most depressing of all is 70% of Hungarians wouldn't even bother reporting a case of corruption. And there's definitely a sense here that it's got worse. And also, the last statistic is very telling. There's a sense that, well, that's how it is, and you can't really do much about it, so it's not worth bothering. And also, if you do bother and report it, you draw a lot of attention to yourself.
Adam, let's move on to something slightly more upbeat then, because, you know, scandals, corruption, you know, political right sort of battles are all a bit depressing. But I gather there's still time to party in Hungary, right? Tell us a little bit about where everyone's going just to kick back and relax a little.
Yes, absolutely. Well, we're going to forget all that stuff about citizenship and passports and corruption, and we're going to party at Sziget. Sziget starts on the 5th of August, and it's one of the biggest summer festivals in Europe now, if not around the world. Tens of thousands of people pour into Sziget, which is Hungarian for island. It all takes place on an island in the Danube, and the party goes on for a week. And all sorts of people are coming. You know, we've got headliners like Dizzy Rascal and Blur, Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds. But there's also an amazing selection of world music, Besho Drom, a local Roma group, Emir Kusturica and his band from Serbia, and people coming from all over the world, Transglobal Underground, all sorts of people. And there's an amazing amount of cultural stuff going on as well, kids programs and theatre programs, dance, all kinds of food, and it's all in on this island in the Danube, so it's in a nice enclosed space, and everyone has a great time.
And Adam, who's your pick then to see at the festival?
I would say definitely go and see Besho Drom, the Hungarian Roma band. Hungarian Gypsy Band, and they're great. They've really kind of brought a modern twist to old gypsy rhythms, and they really get everyone dancing. And gypsy music's fantastic. It's so energetic and lively, and it's really captivating. That would be my pick.
Wonderful stuff, Adam. High energy and lots of drama. I think that's one definitely for Phil Hahn. Adam Labor, Monocle's man in Hungary, thank you very much for joining us here on the programme today. Well, we're going to be looking through some newspapers in a minute. Let's have a little song just to take us there. From Malawi, this is The Very Best with Warm Heart of Africa. Go.
Well, no, it was not Adam Labor's selection. He performs more of a gypsy rhythm. That was Heart of Africa by The Very Best. You're listening to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Tom Edwards. It's time now for us to leaf through some of the front pages this morning. Joining us is Monocle's foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield. Good morning,
Hello.
Steve.
Good morning. I'm very good indeed. And we chose that song because we're going to the warm heart of Africa.
Indeed.
To Nairobi for the first story. The Daily Nation, which is Kenyan's main daily newspaper, has a story which will gladden the hearts of Democrats all over the world. MPs plan China trip to buy chairs for their offices. This is about how a delegation of MPs from Kenya have decided that there's nowhere in Kenya to buy furniture, or indeed anywhere in Africa or in Europe. They have to go all the way to China on a very expensive, luxurious trip just to try and buy some furniture for their offices. Now, I've lived in Kenya. I've bought furniture in Kenya. In fact, very, very good furniture.
So they do have chairs in Kenya.
I bought some amazing chairs on the side of a road, which were a rip-off of Charles Rennie Mackintosh. I gave the guy the design. He was like, yeah, I can do that. And it was 20 quid a chair. They were great. Huh.
Now, Steve, tell me about this. Obviously, as you said, you're a long-time resident of Nairobi. When are we ever going to talk about a story about Kenyan politics, and specifically MPs and their conduct, which isn't about them basically doing something where they can get $900 a day in allowances?
That's going to take a very, very long time. They are Kenyan MPs are some of the best paid in the world, despite the fact that Kenya is one of the poorest countries in the world. And they're better paid than British MPs, for example, as staggering as that may sound. And they...
Even after the British MPs get a modest 11% pay rise.
There was this thing recently, right, a few years ago in Kenya, where... Their basic pay, that like the very tiny bit of it which is basic, is taxed, but the rest, which makes about 90% of what their income is, isn't taxed. And so there are a few ordinary people in Kenya who said, you know what, I feel like you guys should maybe pay some tax. And there was a protest of only about a dozen people, and these guys got held in prison for 2 days because of this protest. And the MP said, okay, we'll be taxed, but only if you increase our salary so that actually
we get paid more.
Exactly. Yeah.
So what's their argument? How are they actually trying to justify this? Or are they not even bothering?
No, they're not even bothering. they're just, you know, the only people who've quoted here are saying, like, I'd like to stop them, but I can't.
that could be the new motto politically in Nairobi, certainly. Steve, we're a bit short of time. Let's move on to a couple more.
Yeah, so
there's
another good Africa story here. I like this one. So the Daily Maverick in South Africa has a story titled The Race to the Top of Africa. Lots of parts of the world, there's a race to have the tallest building. So the Shard, everyone got very excited about it. It's the tallest building in Europe until another tall building comes along. Obviously, we know about all the ones in Dubai and elsewhere. Africa, there hasn't been quite such a race. The tallest building at the moment is the Carlton Centre in Johannesburg, which, if you've been to Johannesburg, is the ugly one that's not... which isn't actually even that tall. It's only 50 stories high. That's 223 metres. So global terms, not very significant, as Simon Allison points out in this piece. But it's all about to change. So Ethiopia this week announced that it's going to try and build Africa's tallest building by 2017. And to have a link to the last story as well, that's going to be built by a Chinese corporation, 99-story building that's going to be. Ghana is also trying to get involved. There's a building called Hope City, which President John Mahama launched in March. If they get it in time before the Ethiopian one, it will be the tallest because it's 75 stories. But not to be outdone, South Africa wants to hold on to its crown. And there's a new project called Symbio City in Centurion, which is in Pretoria and Chithanwe municipality. That will be 447 metres, although, you know, it's not going to be built until 2022, and actually they haven't got the money for it yet.
So what's behind the sudden race to the skies?
Well, I think it's a couple of things. One is that... you know, there's more money going into Africa now, more investment, and also I think it's, you know, the fact that they'd been slightly, it was one of those things that no one had really sort of taken it seriously, and quite rightly actually. I think you shouldn't take it seriously. I mean, who cares about how tall a building is? But it's good PR, you know. If you're Addis Ababa and you can say, look, we've got the tallest building in the world, it's the prestige. So there's more money coming in, and it's the idea that obviously there'll be prestige to it as well. Do we have time for...
We do have time.
Should we go...
Yeah, let's have a quick look.
Okay, so cricket has been going on here in England. If you're English or Australian, then this is pretty much the only thing that matters over the next few months. And England were doing very well yesterday, weren't they, Tom?
I can't, it's too painful for me to talk about this.
They were doing incredibly well until a 19-year-old kid called Ashton Agar, who no one frankly had ever heard of before. He's making his debut, he comes on last, and he scores 98, which was a record for someone batting at number 11, which is basically the worst position. So if you're the worst person in the team, and he came in and scored 98, which is an incredible score, and to do that on your debut as well. So the Sydney Morning Herald has a big story. Agar, the marketable, obviously look at how much money he's going to make now that he's on every front page, like, you know, the Times, with, look, his little smile.
Boy's
there.
Boy's charm.
However much money he makes, Steve, one thing financially is guaranteed. This is a man who'll never have to buy himself a beer again as long as he'll live.
No, Agar will never go without a jar.
Beautiful finish. Steve Bloomfield, Monocle's foreign editor, thanks very much for joining us. That's all we have time for on today's show. Thanks to producer Thomas Lewis, researchers Fernando Pacheco and Tess McCann, our studio manager Bill Luti.
And I'll be back with Dominic Reynolds for Monday's edition of Midori House. But for now, from me, Phil Hahn.
And me, Tom Edwards, thanks for listening.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.